Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Susan Yaki reporting. Chinese Admiral vows Beijing won't be isolated. A senior Chinese military official today rejected the U.S. Defense Secretary's assertion, made the previous day, that Beijing faces erecting a great wall of self-isolation if it continues with provocative militarization of disputed islets in the South China Sea. Admiral Sun Jingguo of the People's Liberation Army said, quote, "We were not isolated in the past. We are not isolated now. We will not be isolated in the future," end quote. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, speaking to reporters in Mongolia today, said Washington would consider any Chinese establishment of an air defense zone over the South China Sea to be a provocative and destabilizing act. Former U.S. President Bill Clinton will be among those who will deliver eulogies at the funeral Friday of boxing legend Muhammad Ali, who died late Friday at age 74 from complications of Parkinson's disease. Davis Miller, author of the book Approaching Ali, tells VOA he thinks everyone will be changed by Ali's death.
The world is just going to stop for a few minutes or a few days. How can the world be without Muhammad Ali? Something about him, as ridiculous as he is, is this fantastic figure. Something about him in that ridiculousness is every bit as hopeful as the space program, traveling to the moon. It was in the 1960s. In the early 70s. It's just absolutely a fantastic human being.
Ali, who was born Cassius Clay in 1942, won three heavyweight boxing titles. President Barack Obama, in a statement, likened the firebrand Ali to Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King Jr. From Washington, this is VOA News. The Syrian army continues to move into the northern province of Raqqa, home to the de facto capital of the Islamic State militants fighting in Syria and neighboring Iraq. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says Syrian troops have reached the administrative border of Raqqa province, backed by Russian airstrikes. Meantime, the U.S. has moved its aircraft carrier, the USS Truman, into the Mediterranean, from where it is supporting not only anti-IS activity in Syria, but also is helping drive the militants from the area around the Iraqi capital. Rear Admiral Brett Battlicher is the commander of Carrier Strike Group 8.
The forward line where we have been conducting the close air support missions has been steadily moving west. And away from Baghdad. So, you know, there's tangible proof that we're actually moving the operation to the west.
The Truman conducted missions from the Persian Gulf before being redeployed to the Mediterranean. Today, as it has in previous years, Iran denounced a recent U.S. State Department report that identified the country as the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism. An Iranian foreign ministry spokesman instead charged that U.S. ally Saudi Arabia was the real leader of funding terrorist activity. The U.S. State Department published its latest annual report Thursday, in which it said Iran increased its support of Palestinian militants in Gaza last year and supported Hezbollah fighters trying to bolster the government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Russia's Deputy Defense Minister Anatoly Antonov today criticized the possible deployment of a U.S. missile defense system in South Korea.
We have serious concerns all about the development on the Korean Peninsula. Russia remains fully committed to non-proliferation regime and non-recognition of DPRK nuclear ambitions. At the same time, we are strongly opposed to excessive military response to Pyongyang actions. We find it absolutely unacceptable to try to use North Korean nuclear missile programs as a pretext to change military political balance in the region.
Pope Francis canonized two new saints today, the Polish founder of the first men's religious order dedicated to the Immaculate Conception, and a Lutheran convert who hid Jews during World War II. Pope Francis canonized the Polish priest Stanislaus of Jesus and Mary and the Swedish nurse and Catholic convert Maria Elizabeth Helselbad. Muslims around the world are preparing to observe the holy month of Ramadan, which is expected to begin late today or Monday, depending on the first sighting of the new moon. The faithful are expected to spend the month fasting during daylight hours and spending more time in prayer and the study of the Quran. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
You may recall in 2015, I stood as a candidate. That was a snappy election, which was totally unnecessary if we had a constitution in place.
The first female Zambian presidential candidate vows to defeat incumbent President Edgar Lungu in the upcoming August 11 general election.
National Chairman Simon Kayamo said that ZANU-PF is not worried by a coalition of small parties.
Zimbabwean opposition political parties form an alliance ahead of the next elections.
The primary intent of this is simply to feed organized criminal networks with profit. Most of these networks are either focused on charcoal or high-value logs.
And Kenya loses tens of thousands of hectares of forest land each year because of illegal logging. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The leader of the Zambian Opposition Forum for Democracy and Development, or FDD, Edith Nawakwi, has vowed to shock the world by defeating incumbent President Edgar Lungu and main opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema in the upcoming August 11 presidential election. Ms. Nawakwi, the country's first female presidential candidate, told me she is the most qualified among all the candidates.
We have been campaigning for the last 5 years since the 2011 election. As you may recall, in 2015, I stood as a candidate. That was a snappy election, which was totally unnecessary if we had a constitution in place. So my name is a household name in the villages and everywhere. And the fact that we have created a credible team on the ground is resonating very well with the voters in the Christian circles. We have incorporated people of all faiths, the Muslim community, the Christians, and most of our supporters to our right are young people and mostly women, because they believe that FDD has a policy that are targeted at eradicating poverty, creating employment, and basically we are the most peaceful party in the country.
There's a constitutional provision of 50% plus one, a new one. Realistically, how credible do you think, what do you think your chances are to meet this constitutional provision to win the presidential election on August 11?
Frankly speaking, if you take account of the other candidates, the ruling party is split. The people in the ruling party have migrated to the opposition party. So much so that it has lost its character of UPND. It's half PF and half UPND. And you look at the ruling party, if you the recent happenings and you hear about them, half of them, MMD, have gone to PF. So basically the two parties are the same in character, and people are looking for an alternative. When you say realistically speaking, my chances are far much brighter than one of my competitors. If you look at today's Daily Mail, you can go online and look at the credentials of all the candidates. I am the most qualified. I have served 10 years as cabinet minister in different portfolios, finance, agriculture, energy, which is an issue here. We live in perpetual blackouts, and the current president has no solution for that. This time, we have created a real impact. That's why you see that the ruling party presidential candidate was busy telling the country that he's going to adopt a female running mate, and so were the others. It is out of the impact that has been created in my presence on the political arena.
There have been talks of alliances here and there with other political parties in the run-up to the election. Is the FDD willing to form an alliance with any party to enhance your chances ahead of the presidential vote.
Well, I don't know what alliances you're talking about, because the FDP has been in an alliance before with UPND in 2006, and we didn't win. At the time, we had the three political parties. UPND itself had been in an alliance with Patriotic Front. They've been in an alliance with MMP in the last election. They didn't win. The talk of alliances came about because the President of the Republic and the opposition political parties, they wanted to slow down the momentum which I had created on the ground. Well, whenever they go, people say, this time around, they want a mother. And in fact, there's a catchphrase which the young people on the street are talking about. When you talk to them, they say, in my office, it's just the mother that we want.
You have been in government for a very long time. You have all the credentials. However, didn't you contribute to the deplorable condition that many Zambians currently face? Because you were a cabinet minister, you made decisions that did not possibly resolve all these problems that you have just enumerated.
You have to go back to the history. We took over in 1991 at a time when the entire African continent was going through extreme difficult conditions, which were created by, in our country, by the unit government, the first government. And we had to go through a painful structural adjustment program. To our credit, by the time we left, we had managed to get the debt to a level which was sustainable and manageable. In the last 5 years, this Patriotic Front government has moved our country from nearly 1 billion debt on the books to over 13 billion.
Edith Nawakwi is the leader of the Zambian Opposition Forum for Democracy and Development, or FDD. She spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Smaller opposition parties in Zimbabwe have formed a coalition to challenge President Robert Mugabe's governing ZANU-PF party in the next general election. This after Mr. Mugabe recently expressed concern about factions within the party, which he said could weaken ZANU-PF ahead of the poll. For more on the political situation, I reached Nicholas Magiza, an independent journalist in the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
One of the reactions that has been from the ruling ZANU-PF party is National Chairman Simon Kayamoe said that ZANU-PF is not worried by a coalition of small parties. He says that Zimbabwe is a democratic country and people are free to do what they want, and they are not really concerned by a group of people forming a little coalition. He says that they fear no one as ZANU-PF and that they are a strong party. But as well, it's quite interesting that political analysts also seem to discount the coalition as a weak one. Political analyst Ibo Mandaza believes that among the party, there's no one with an appeal as a presidential candidate. And also that as long as big parties are not involved, the other parties are really minor parties that cannot get much votes.
Wouldn't this new opposition coalition divide the vote of the opposition parties to pose any significant threat to the ZANU-PF party?
Yeah, precisely. I think that they've done well to come together. But I think the biggest, their biggest weakness, they are saying, is that it doesn't include the opposition, one of the biggest opposition parties, which is the MDC, led by Morgan Tsvangirai, as well as also the another party that was formed by former Vice President Teurai Mujuru, and also one that is led by Tendai Biti, who is the former Secretary General of the MDC, led by Tsvangirai. So you find that, yes, there is that element that the opposition vote would be split if these other parties are not part of the coalition. So that is the biggest weakness that, you know, political analysts and the general people are saying, that as long as those three other parties are not part of this coalition, then the coalition is weak and it's not going to, you know, pose any significant threat to the party and ruling ZANU-PF.
President Robert Mugabe recently came out saying that there appears to be splinter groups within the ZANU-PF. What is the current situation in the ZANU-PF party that you're hearing from the ground?
Yes, indeed it's true that there is also some disturbances within ZANU-PF itself. ZANU-PF is not united as things stand. There is some factions, one that's led by Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa, and another one that is purportedly led by the president's wife, that's Grace Mugabe. So, yes, ZANU-PF is also divided amongst itself. Quite recently, I think the day before yesterday, the war veterans came out supporting the faction led by VP Mnangagwa, saying that they supported VP Mnangagwa and that they believe that is the one that will succeed President Robert Mugabe. So the ZANU-PF house itself is not in order, and there appears also to be weaknesses and factions within it.
Nicholas Magiza is an independent Zimbabwean journalist. He spoke with me from the capital, Harare. At a recent forum on how Sudanese civil society activists can help achieve gender equality, participants agreed that women face enormous challenges in claiming their rights. They say there isn't any deliberate Sudanese government policy to empower women. For VOA, Nabil Biagio has more from the capital, Khartoum.
The forum was aimed at developing strategies on how Sudanese civil society organizations can work together to try to achieve the United Nations Sustainable Development Goal of gender equality and the empowerment of all women and girls. The Khartoum-based Gender Studies Center, which fights discrimination against women and girls, organized the forum. Ni'mat Kuku, team leader at the Gender Studies Center, says achieving gender equality in Sudan is a huge uphill battle.
Many challenges are facing Sudanese women, particularly related to issue of development, political will to achieve the development indicators, challenges of financing the developments, because this is not the priority for the government.
Kuku says in order for Sudanese women to claim their rights as equal citizens of society, all civil society sectors, including the government and media, must work together to achieve the UN's Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs.
What the civil society can do is to advocate for the SDGs, to link its efforts with policymakers and planners, to use the media for advocacy and to raise the awareness of mass media to address and tackle the SDGs, to achieve the social justice, women's rights, and gender equality.
Amal Abu Zaid is a member of ASMA Development Association, a local non-governmental organization. Speaking in Arabic, Abu Zaid says Sudanese civil society activists need to put more pressure on government officials to develop a clear plan for achieving sustainable development through gender equality.
Sudan doesn't have a specific strategic plan for achieving the fifth goal of the SDGs concerning gender and equality. This shows that government is not sure about the issue and that adaptation of those goals.
Abu Zaid says the wars in Darfur, South Kordofan, and Blue Nile States have torn apart thousands of Sudanese families and left vulnerable women and girls to fend for themselves after losing their husbands and guardians. She says this makes empowering women and alleviating their suffering an urgent priority. One participant, a legal activist who did not want to be identified by name because she fears government reprisal, says one issue that hampers women's economic empowerment is Sudan's crackdown on small unregulated businesses run by women. She says a primary example for that is the tea-selling business that thousands of women take on in Khartoum in order to earn a little money of their own.
Women in unregulated business face harsh regulation, especially the police order law, which is effectively a war on those women that comes with a lot of violence. A poor woman would be working all the day in the street to feed her children. When Sudan police Pride would rob her and all her equipment and give her a fine that is 2 times more than she makes in a day.
Activists who attended the one-day forum will gather their recommendations and call on government officials to enact laws that protect the rights of women. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
According to a new report, Kenya loses 70,000 hectares of forest each year because of illegal logging. The report, released ahead of World Environment Day Sunday, cites organized crime as the main cause of the logging and calls it an enemy of the environment. For VOA, Lenny Ruvaga reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
A joint report by the United Nations Environment Programme, UNEP, and Interpol says that Kenya is losing much of its forest cover to illegal logging and trade in precious timber. The report, titled The Rise of Environmental Crime, released ahead of World Environment Day on Sunday, the 5th of June, finds that weak laws are to blame for the rise in illegal logging in Kenya. Individuals cut down many trees to make charcoal, which provides energy for approximately 80% of urban and 35% of rural households. But Christian Nelman, the author of the report, says organized crime is the main culprit.
Well, the primary intent of this is simply to feed organized criminal networks with profit. Most of these networks are either focused on charcoal or high-value logs for exports, particularly to Asia.
The Kenya Forest Service is the agency responsible for preserving the country's wooded areas. The deputy director in charge of forest conservation and management, Charity Munyasi, disputes the report. She says the KFS is executing its mandate with efficiency.
That report is not telling the truth, because actually the illegal loggers in this country have reduced. We have even removed issues of those people who want to be given logging licenses without sawmills. And Kenya Forest Service does not allow people without legal licenses to remove wood from the gazette and forest areas.
Interpol cites the coastal city of Mombasa as a conduit for the illegal logging trade. David Stewart is with Interpol's Environment Security Program.
Kenya, with its port in Mombasa, is a significant transit point for a lot of timber and a lot of illegal timber moving either from other parts of Africa via the port in Mombasa before heading on to Asia.
The new report says Kenya needs to adapt its law enforcement mechanisms or it will lose the war to save the environment to shrewd criminals.
What you've got is criminal groups moving in. They're operating in a very sophisticated manner, using shell companies and very elaborate sort of tax schemes that are set up, looking at various legal loopholes and using those to help launder the timber and to launder the proceeds. And law enforcement itself is struggling to keep up. The investment in law enforcement is not enough.
According to government data, forest covers about 7% of Kenya's land. Lenny Ruvaga, VOA News in Nairobi.
Two Israeli companies say they used a specialized 3D printer to create an environment in which stem cells could grow into a specific tissue. In the near future, the technology could be used for testing new drugs, but it also opens up the possibility of growing organ replacements. VOA's George Putish has more from Washington.
In 2006, Japanese scientist Shinya Yamanaka and his team discovered that common human cells, such as skin cells, can be turned into stem cells previously harvested from embryos. With ethical concerns about using embryonic stem cells removed, many researchers around the world started experimenting with tissue regeneration. The so-called induced pluripotent stem cells, or iPS cells, are now being used for replacing simpler tissues in the human body lost to disease or injury. The process is still slow, but Israeli 3D printer manufacturer NanoDimension and Acelta, a company that produces iPS cells, now say they have tested a 3D printer capable of fast production of human stem cells. Amit Dror is the CEO of NanoDimension.
I have to emphasize that what we've done so far is a proof of concept. We didn't grow a fully, you know, functional human tissue that is actually going to all kinds of medical usages, but we have proven that we have the ability, by combining the know-how and IP of both companies, to get to the right materials and basically being able to print very fast an array which resembles a tissue by using human stem cells.
Dror says special ink containing living stem cells combined with other substances that stabilize the environment and support their growth can be printed very quickly. Another advantage of 3D printing over manual preparation of substrate for growth of stem cells is the ability to precisely control the ingredients and sequence of their layering.
It's not good enough just to mix the different components, if you got. You want to set them in a way that resembles the human body, because it's not that every layer of tissue within any organ or skin or any part of the body has just a mixture of cells. They are located in different concentrations in different places. It could be that you have a few cells of one type in one spot, and then next to it, some different type of cells. The ability to accurately place in the right position the types of cells gives an advantage in order to generate a tissue that really resembles the human body.
The director of the University of Pittsburgh's McGown Institute for Regenerative Medicine, William Wagner, says printing stem cells in a certain shape is relatively easy, but turning them into functional tissue is going to be a challenge. He says, however, that printing a representative slice that behaves like a certain tissue can be very useful.
Let's say you're looking at a drug that would fix liver disease that causes the liver to not be able to enzymatically degrade some substance. Now you have the ability to do 1,000 experiments in parallel with liver tissue, with your drug, assessing the effectiveness of it.
Wagner says regeneration of complicated human tissues, such as full organs, is still a long way off. So the most likely successes for tissue printing are going to be simpler tissues, like skin or muscle, or maybe even as complicated as intestinal wall. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Batty, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. Tune in to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in Feast your ears and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Good evening, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with the passing of boxing legend Muhammad Ali, who died after a 32-year battle with Parkinson's disease. He was 74, born on January 17, 1942. VOA's Carla Bapp brings us the story of one of the most beloved and most controversial American athletes.
This son of a Kentucky painter took up boxing after neighborhood bullies stole his bicycle. His trainer said the boy, then known as Cassius Clay, grew to mix raw talent with determination.
A dynamite right, sends Archie Moore crashing to the floor.
In 1964, he shocked overwhelming favorite Sonny Liston to win his first world heavyweight title.
Shorts kills him right to the jaw, Liston goes down.
Washington Post newspaper sports columnist Mike Wise says the confident boxing great continued to dominate, fighting with both his fists.
These represent dynamite.
And his words.
He was probably the first guy, the first athlete in America to brag about something and back it up. Nobody boasted in those days.
I'm the greatest, and I'm knocking out all bones. And if you get too small, I'll knock you out.
Clay had joined the Nation of Islam and changed his name after that fight to one that is revered around the world, Muhammad Ali. 3 years later, he was vilified for refusing the U.S. Army draft based on his religious beliefs and his opposition to the Vietnam War. Ali was convicted of draft evasion and stripped of his title, keeping him out of the ring for 3 years until the Supreme Court overturned his conviction in 1970. Just months after returning to the ring, new heavyweight champ Joe Frazier dealt Ali his first professional loss. But Ali later took his revenge against Smoking Joe Frazier and won their second fight. Another classic bout for Ali was against George Foreman. Ali and Foreman took their 1974 championship fight to the former Zaire in a remote part of Central Africa. It was a boxing match immortalized as the Rumble in the Jungle.
I have wrestled with an alligator. I have tussled with a whale. I done handcuffed lightning, throw thunder in jail. Bad, ain't it? Only last week, I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalized a brick. I'm so mean, I make medicine sick. Bad, fast.
And for him to employ what people think still to this day is one of the most amazing strategies, act like you're tired, let the big guy punch himself out, and then all of a sudden galvanize yourself and find a way to knock him out in the eighth round. Well, that was still probably the most triumphant moment in boxing history.
The great man has done it.
Ali then met Frazier in their third and final clash. It was late 1975 in the Philippines, dubbed the Thrilla in Manila. Ali endured 14 brutal rounds and emerged victorious. The boxing legend's later years were plagued by Parkinson's disease, which he was diagnosed with in 1984. He could no longer float like a butterfly or sting like a bee, but his generosity and passion for humanity continued to inspire people around the world.
Muhammad Ali was beloved. There was a heart component that I don't think anybody will ever touch.
Whether loved or hated, Muhammad Ali certainly made people feel. And that, perhaps even more than his boxing prowess, will be his lasting legacy. Carla Babb, VOA News, Washington.
A procession Friday will lead through the streets of Louisville, traveling down the street named after him and passing through Ali's old neighborhood. The procession will end at Cave Hill Cemetery, where he will be laid to rest. An interfaith service open to the public will be held at 2 p.m. Friday. In other sports news, Egypt and Senegal qualified for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations finals in Gabon on Saturday. Roma winger Mohamed Salah scored both of Egypt's goals in a 2-0 victory away to Tanzania as they returned to the finals of the Nations Cup for the first time since 2010. Senegal sealed their place at Gabon 2017 thanks to goals from their English Premier League players Sadio Mane and Mame Biram Diouf, who both scored in a 2-0 win away to Burundi. The group's other fixture was a fight for survival, with Namibia beating Niger 1-0 courtesy of a 15th-minute goal from Peter Shalulile. The win keeps Namibia's hopes of finishing as one of the best second-place sides alive, but Niger cannot now qualify. Guinea-Bissau are on the verge of their first-ever appearance at an African Cup of Nations finals after securing a 3-2 home win over 2012 champions Zambia. Zambia now face a struggle to secure one of the best second-place spots. Uganda moved closer towards qualification with a vital 2-1 win away to Botswana to move 3 points clear at the top of Group D. Group C leaders Mali also improved their chances of advancing to the finals with a 3-0 win away to South Sudan. Mali's victory moves them 5 points ahead of second-placed Benin, who will now play their Group C match against Equatorial Guinea on Sunday, June 12th, after FIFA conditionally lifted Benin's ban. Sierra Leone moved to within a point of reigning African champions and Group I leaders Ivory Coast with a 1-0 win over Sudan in Freetown. South Africa had an emphatic 4-0 win away to the Gambia. In Group H, in Kigali, second-place Rwanda lost 2-3 to visitors Mozambique, who sit bottom of the group. In Group F, Cape Verde boosted their hopes of qualifying as one of the two best runners-up with a 2-1 win away to Sao Tome and Principe. Morocco has already qualified as Group F winners. The final round of group matches will be played in September. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Collabo, call me my portrait, I
Sunday Music Spot. I hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The Somali militant terrorist group Al-Shabaab that is affiliated with Al-Qaeda struck again in Mogadishu last week. This resulted in the death of over 20 people, including two parliamentarians. The attack by Al-Shabaab fighters and the hotel came just a few hours prior to the arrival of Britain's Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond on a visit to Mogadishu. There are two perspectives about developments in Somalia. The more optimistic view is that the disaster in Somalia of the 1990s are all over, and there is greater security among the people in the country. Much credit is given to AMISOM, the African Union peacekeeping force that is backed by the United Nations. AMISOM has been able to push Al-Shabaab from all major cities in the country, and in the view of many, Al-Shabaab is on the run. It is also mentioned that for the first time in a long time, Somalia now has a national parliament and a single president. These are all seen as major improvements, with the economy improving also. Then there is the increased focus of the major powers in Somalia. Mention was just made about the visit of the UK Foreign Secretary. There are reports that the United States is operating in and around Somalia in search of terrorists. There is also the major factor of Turkey. The president of Turkey has just paid his third visit to Somalia, and he pledged support for the co-religionist Muslims of Somalia. But there is also another perspective, and that states that despite all these security successes pushing Al-Shabaab out of major cities, Al-Shabaab has proved that it could strike at any time of its own choosing. It has struck at the airport in Mogadishu. It has struck many times in many places in Somalia. And also, Al-Shabaab has used its base in Somalia to attack neighboring countries such as Kenya. In fact, it was only last week that it was reported that the man who led the dastardly attack as Garissa in Kenya, when so many students were killed, was himself killed by drone strike in Somalia. There is also the worry that even though there might have been improvement in the security and some veneer of political development, there is no attempt being shown either by the African Union or the Somalis themselves to see whether there could be any reconciliation between Al-Shabaab and the government. Yes, it's true that Al-Shabaab is a terrorist group allied with Al-Qaeda. But if you take Afghanistan, the Taliban have been behaving just as bad as Al-Shabaab, yet there are talks to bring about negotiations between the Taliban and the government in Afghanistan. There is also the worry in Somalia that despite all efforts, no political development has been made. There should be elections in November, but the political class is not yet ready to allow the people of Somalia to choose their own legislators and president. The plans are to resort to the electoral college of clan leaders. This is not the way to stabilize a country. Democracy demands that the people themselves, in direct elections, must elect their government. When people elect their own government, they are more prepared to defend it with life and limb. And this is not what should be the case in Somalia by only using clan leaders to elect leaders. There is also the insecurity. Mention is made by the U.S. involvement in the search for terrorists in Somalia. There are reports that within a short time, the British government will send 70 soldiers to bolster security at the much-attacked airport in Mogadishu. So despite all of this, the UN, the African Union, must be encouraged to see that political development is on the agenda and to make it possible for the Somali people to select their own government. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, every camel was once upon a time 2 years old. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The State Department has designated the Tariq Jadar Group, or TGG, and Jamaat al-Dawa al-Quran, or JDQ, as specially designated global terrorists. This designation imposes sanctions on foreign entities determined to have committed or pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism that threaten the security of Americans or the United States. As a result of these designations, all property under U.S. jurisdiction in which the TGG or JDQ have any interest is blocked, and American citizens are generally prohibited from engaging in any transactions with the TGG or JDQ. The TGG is a Pakistani Taliban-linked group based in Dara al-Damkel, Pakistan. The TGG is responsible for multiple large-scale fatal attacks, including the December 2014 massacre at the Army Public School in Peshawar, Pakistan, that left 132 schoolchildren and 9 staffers dead, the deadliest terrorist attack in Pakistan's history. TGG's leader, Umar Mansour, is also known as the mastermind of the January 2016 attack on Bacha Khan University in Charsada, Pakistan, that killed 20 and wounded between 50 and 60 others. In addition to these devastating attacks, the TGG is responsible for the 2010 kidnapping of a British journalist traveling to North Waziristan, Pakistan, and the 2008 kidnapping and beheading of Polish geologist Piotr Stanchak in Attock, Pakistan. JDQ is a terrorist group based in Peshawar, Pakistan, and eastern Afghanistan, which pledged allegiance in 2010 to now-deceased Taliban Emir Mullah Omar and has long-standing ties to Al-Qaeda and Lashkar-e-Taiba. JDQ has been responsible for various attacks, including the infamous 2010 kidnapping and death of British aid worker Linda Norgrove in Kunar Province, Afghanistan. The imposition of sanctions are a powerful tool against terrorists. With these actions, the U.S. is notifying the American public and the international community that TGG and JDQ are actively engaged in terrorism. Terrorism designations enable the government to coordinate actions to disrupt the activities of terrorists, including denying them access to the U.S. financial system and enabling U.S. law enforcement actions. The United States will continue to expose, isolate, and sanction those who commit acts of terrorism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.